This is Karen Brewster. Today is February 4th, 2021. And here with Dick and Mary Bishop, continuing our conversations. This is interview number 4 we're doing. And Tom Paragai is with us as well, and we'll be chiming in. And we are all in Fairbanks, Alaska, but in 3 different houses and speaking over Zoom. So thank you, Dick and Mary, for finding more time to talk with us today. And we were going to focus on the Alaska Outdoor Council, which is something we've talked about a little bit in the past, but thought we should maybe focus in a little bit more on. So Dick, would you like to describe what the Alaska Outdoor Council is for people who don't know?
Yes, thank you.
And I should say we will often refer to it as AOC, probably, instead of its full name.
Sure. Mary and I reshuffled each other's papers. Now looking.
Looking for your notes.
She's looking for her pile of stuff, and I moved, so I'm looking for my pile of stuff. But anyway.
Well, I have the problem that I move my own piles of stuff, and then I can't find them.
Yes, that's my problem right now.
Sounds familiar. Anyway, the Alaska Outdoor Council, I wanted to go back just briefly to Anilka, because it comes up so prominently in what the Alaska Outdoor Council did later, and just a couple things. At one point, during its earlier organization, the Alaska Outdoor Council, which had a little different name at the time, was affiliated with the National Wildlife Federation. And that came up as a significant insight into the strategy involved in the NILCA. And it came up in this way. When the Alaska Coalition, the set of environmental groups organized as the Alaska Coalition to promote ANILCA, their view of ANILCA, the National Wildlife Federation was not invited, even though at the time it probably was the leading conservation as opposed to strictly environmental organization in the country by virtue of its broad representation across the country. The problem that the Wildlife Federation had, or that the Alaska Coalition had with the Wildlife Federation, was that the Wildlife Federation supported and promoted hunting. The Alaska Coalition scorned organizations that strongly represented and supported hunting. That included the Wildlife Federation and also another prominent conservation group in the country nationwide was the Isaac Walton League. And they were similarly excluded from invitation to join the Alaska Coalition. This comes up later on with the Alaska Outdoor Council and the National Wildlife Federation. Toward the end of negotiations on ANILCA, the National Wildlife Federation was invited to join the Alaska Coalition, and it was kind of because they'd been so prominent, their nose was really out of joint, they'd been left out. Overtures were made, compromises were made by the Federation, and they joined, and that came back in the context of AOC much later. Isaac Walton League never did join the Alaska Coalition.
And the Isaac Walton League was similar, that they were supportive of hunting?
Yeah, hunting, fishing, and trapping, and as the name denotes, they were pretty pretty strong on fishing in particular. So after Isaac Walton, the famous original sport fisherman. Anyway, so it's interesting how those, there are tendrils of these things running through time that affect later events. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, the Alaska Outdoor Council, as we know it now, was organized in 1983 from the Alaska Sportsmen's Federation and Outdoor Council, which was a coalition of the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association, Matanuska Valley Sportsmen's Association, and Territorial Sportsmen, which is in Juneau. Those were probably and they formed that previous organization, the Alaska Wildlife Federation, in 1955, I believe.
Yes.
And carried on from there. They were very much involved in issues relating to hunting and fishing. At the time, I don't know this for sure, but I think there were very, very few other outdoor local, that is Alaskan clubs of any sort for that matter. And so it was a pretty short thing.
Yeah, because the Alaska Conservation Society, which would have been the first similar outdoors organization, came in the 60s.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. And they certainly had different perspectives on issues, but it. So that's interesting that the sportsmen's. What was it? The Alaska Sportsmen's.
Foundation. Territorial Sportsmen.
What was it called? The Alaska Sportsmen's Foundation?
Oh.
Federation.
Officially, Alaska Wildlife Federation and Sportsmen's Council.
Okay. So was it affiliated with the National Wildlife Federation?
I think it probably was. And Mary's got something to say.
It's the old Sportsmen's Council, Alaska Wildlife Federation and Sportsmen's Council, had been a member of the National Wildlife Federation for about 25 years or more. And in the newsletter, the newspaper, there's a
Out of Doors in Alaska,
right?
Which for the first meeting, the reorganizational meeting, there's a long article about the affiliation with the National Wildlife Federation. And the big issue in that December 1982 meeting was whether or not to rejoin with the National Wildlife Federation. And there was an article that gave the pros and cons and talked about the Sportsmen's Council's previous affiliation with the NWF,
right.
Pros and cons, and the delegates voted to not reaffiliate.
Can you summarize why?
Yes, the reason they voted not to reaffiliate was that in the meanwhile, as they described, the National Wildlife Federation had joined the Alaska Coalition and had supported the provisions of ANILCA that the Alaska Outdoor Council by that time came to oppose.
Okay, that makes sense.
So anyway, so Alaska Outdoor Council, as we know today, reorganized in 1983. And one thing that happened was quite an expansion of membership of clubs in order to try to reach out to a broader spectrum of the Alaska public, mainly along the lines of those most clubs most interested in fishing, hunting, trapping, and public access to public lands and waters. So as a result of that, as it stands today, there's approximately 40 affiliated clubs that belong to the Alaska Outdoor Council. They're called affiliates. And
other organizations.
Affiliate organizations, and their members, they pay dues to the Alaska Outdoor Council as a club, and their members become members of AOC by virtue of belonging to those affiliate clubs. So if you add it all up in round figures, and it keeps changing because clubs come and go and become active and inactive in turn, there's somewhere around 10,000 people that are at least officially linked to the Alaska Outdoor Council as it stands today.
Wow. So these affiliate clubs are sort of like a chapter of the larger statewide umbrella organization?
No. No, they're an independent organization. They are, I think affiliate is a good word.
Right.
They have mutual interests, recognized mutual interests. They pay dues to be affiliates. They participate in the annual meeting of the Alaska Outdoor Council, which is principally a business meeting. So they participate in discussions, debates, decisions that are made at the annual meeting of the Alaska Outdoor Council.
And then would they also participate in, you know, lobbying efforts and things like that?
They might very well. One provision of how AOC is organized is that member clubs are free to disagree. They're not bound to whatever position Alaska Outdoor Council board members take, and there is an AOC board and set of officers. So they can go their own way. They're encouraged to tackle challenges on their own, ask for AOC's help, and that's often the case. It's kind of a cooperative thing. And hopefully AOC will hear from them when there's some kind of a problem with anything from hunting regulations to public access to things like this subsistence priority, any number of things. Just to go back for a minute to the original organization, Stanana Valley Sportsmen's Association was incorporated in 1937. Its antecedents go back in Fairbanks to 1911 with the Fairbanks Rifle Club. The Territorial Sportsmen organized formally in 1945. Matt Valley Sportsmen, I don't have a date for, but I suspect it was in that post-World War II period as well. It could have been earlier. I think once World War II ended, there was kind of a, I don't have any documentation of this, but I think there was kind of a resurgence of interest in issues like that when people had the time and the means, and a lot of people who had been in the Army or other services were back in the country.
It also may be that Alaska's population increased with the military people being stationed in Alaska, and they liked Alaska and they stayed and liked that kind of frontier living
Yep, I'm sure that contributed to it.
Yeah.
Certainly, after World War II, there was somewhere I ran across the reference to the fact that there was a lot of people that headed for Alaska not too long after World War II, including among them our former landlords when we first got up here in 61, who had driven their civilian Jeep up the Alaska Highway in 1946. So they didn't wait long. Both of them were veterans, both the husband and wife.
Claude and Susie Swaim.
Yeah, Claude and Susie Swaim.
Okay.
And lived in Fairbanks for a long time.
I've heard Susie Swain's name.
Yeah.
I think she and Mike Dalton were good friends.
I'm sure they were. Susie.
Members of the College Women's Club.
That's how Mike Dalton talked to me about Susie and their work in the women's club.
Mary Binkley was another member of it. It was a very active group.
Right.
And Claude worked for the Coast and Geodetic family. They were an interesting couple. But I won't get sidetracked there, except to say that Claude taught me to save everything that could be useful, because you never know when you're going to need it or if you can get it when you do.
Yeah, the true homesteader philosophy.
That's right. So anyway.
So you were saying the Tano Valley Sportsmen's Association, the Territorial Sportsmen's Group, the Mattoo Valley Sportsmen's
Association. Yeah. Matanuska Valley Sportsman is the name.
Okay. And were there other ones in that initial group?
Nope, those are the only ones. That's kind of unique. And I would just add that I know from looking at TVSA's history, they were very active in fish and game regulations and also in advising the Constitutional Convention and public officials at the time about what should be done in terms of the Constitution and how fish and game should be set up. And Mary wants to take yep. over now.
Okay.
For a while, anyway.
Right. You guys will be.
I may get the last word.
Well, I have some specific names for you.
Okay.
In the summer of 1955, six men signed their names to the Articles of Incorporation for the Alaska Sportsmen's Council, which is the predecessor of the AOC. And in the original Articles of Incorporation, they were signed by Burton Ahlstrom, and I don't know where he's from, Bud Bodie, who was Southeast, I believe. Juneau.
He was the head of Territorial Sportsmen.
Okay. Glenn Despain, who was very active in the local TVSA. Bruce Graham, who I think is in Palmer, probably with the Matt Valley.
Yes.
Edward Howell and Maurice Kelly. And I don't know either of them. And they had four or five really important things that they had in the Articles of Incorporation: to unite the sportsmen of Alaska, to procure enactment of laws for the management of fishing game, to promote sportsmen-like methods, I'm shortening these from what's written, to foster the education of the public and the youth of the territory in matters of conservation, recreation, and good sportsmanship. And these were in the Articles of Incorporation and duplicated by AOC later. I think it's something like the 30th anniversary. By the time I'm getting this information, largely from the printed information from that we put out in the quarterly newsletters. And in September of 83 was the first newsletter that was put out. And it was put out by the Sportsmen's Council, but also by that time, and it was just, you know, like maybe a month or two old, the Alaska Fish and Wildlife Conservation Fund had been established, and it was the 501c3 nonprofit associated with the council, with the Sportsman's Council. And that had been established, and the board of directors for that group had been established, and they had hired Ron Somerville as executive director. He had been former director of the Division of Game for Fish and Game. And it was largely set up at the instigation of local sportsman Bill Waugeman. And I imagine Bill Waugeman was very active in a local group called the Interior Wildlife Association.
No, that came out a little later.
Interior Wildlife Association, yes. And that was a small group that included Waugeman, Bill Stroker, and Chuck Gray and Dick Burley, and probably a few others, but those are the names I...
Bud Wheezy,
yes. And they were very active, and especially active, I'm sure, during the statehood development. And so by the time the end of 1983 came along, Somerville had been hired, and the 501c3 was organized as the Alaska Fish and Wildlife Conservation Fund, but we were still, the name was the Sportsman's Council. And so they had a reorganizational meeting. That was what Waugeman and their group really felt there was a need to re-energize the Sportsman's Council and get them going, especially after what all was happening with ANILCA. And so the first annual meeting was on Saturday, December 3, 2, 3, and 4, at International Inn in Anchorage. And at that time, they did have delegates from this members organizations of the Sportsman's Council. And there was about 15 of them. Some of the local ones that are still active are the Chitnid Dip Netters, and Interior Trail Riders is no longer active, but they were very active. And the Interior Wildlife Association, Midnight Sunfly Casters, Matt Valley Sportsmen, Sitka Sportsmen, Tenino Valley Sportsmen. And so delegates from those approximately 15 groups came together, and they passed they were the ones that voted not to rejoin National Wildlife Federation. That was a big issue. They also voted to rename it into the Alaska Fish and Wildlife Federation and Outdoor Council. They, although it's mainly hunting, fishing, trapping groups, they also put an emphasis on bringing in other outdoor users. And for quite a while, we had a group of mushroom collectors, I remember that. And we had a group of
skydivers
and some other groups of that nature. And there was a push to do that. While I had been on the board of directors for a short time of the Sportsman's Council, and there was 9 on that board of directors, When it was reorganized, there was 7 on the board of directors, and I was no longer on it. If you hear the rattling of papers, that's because I'm looking at these stiff old newspapers.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you have those to refer to.
Yeah, they're quite handy. Anyway, at that meeting, they did accept the new name. They went out. They disaffiliated, voted to disaffiliate with the National Wildlife Federation, and they passed some policies at that time, which were later expanded upon. And another thing, at that meeting, there was a fellow came up from Ohio, I think they're from.
The organization is now known as Sportsman's Alliance.
Yeah, the organization now known Sportsman Alliance. At that time, it was known as the Wildlife Legislation, Wildlife Legislative Fund of America, WLFA. And they had and that was their C4, but they also had a C3 associated with it, WCFA, Wildlife Conservation Fund of America. And they urged our group to organize in the same fashion with a C4 and a C3. And I see that is really common on most organizations now, so that part of them is a lobbyist group and part of them is mainly takes in money to for litigation and research and education.
The C4 is the lobbying side. The lobbying. C3 is the nonprofit.
Right. Okay. Yeah. They're both nonprofits, so they don't have to pay taxes. I think that's the way it works. Yeah. But C4, you don't. If you donate to a C4, it's not tax deductible.
Right. Okay.
And they can do lobbying, extensive. A C4 cannot do the extensive lobbying. They can do education. C3. They can do education on an issue, but they can't campaign for an individual. And I don't think they can campaign on an issue either. I'm not positive about that.
I think the C3 is the tax deductible contribution.
Right. That's it.
No, the C3 is the tax deductible.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. So anyway, in December 1983, the issues that were discussed was, again, the National Wildlife Federation, that the sportsman's group had been a member of for over 25 years, according to my little article here. The navigable waters, subsistence, tribal sovereignty, predator-prey management, animal rights issues was very active at the time, and basically anti-hunting, fishing, trapping, Board of Fish and Game stuff, were they two different organizations or just one? I can't remember at that time if they were. Was it the Board of Fish and Game, or was it the Board of Fish and the Board of Game?
They were combined at that time.
They were combined at that time, okay. Then shortly after, some of the issues that we got into were the 1991 amendments to ANCSA, and which were they were not called the 1991 amendments because it was 20 years after ANILCA, and there was something in, I mean, ANCSA. There was something in ANCSA that indicated that amendments had to be accomplished within 20 years or something like that.
I know
that.
It was about the sale of shareholder stock.
Oh, yes.
Until 1991, they could not be sold, and the original legislation said after 1991, people would have the ability to sell those, and so it brought up the issue of whether the corporations wanted to let that happen or not. And then there were other issues, I'm sure, piled in there, but that was
right,
the initial impetus.
But it was those other issues that affected our interests. One that was not particularly involved with our issues, but it was telling in my personal aspect, was the land bank issue. ANCSA originally, I may not have this perfectly right, but ANCSA originally said that corporations could put their land into a land bank, and then when they got it into the land bank, they could not develop it, but it also would not be eligible for any taxation, and it wouldn't be. I originally opposed the amendment that would have basically gotten rid of the land bank. And I thought it was a reasonable thing to do. And then I heard arguments opposed to having the land bank and just getting rid of it. And the prime argument that I heard was, I think it was Galena Native Corporation, or it might have been Doyon. It took them 10 years to get their land that they applied for into land bank. Because of all the bureaucratic paperwork, etc., it took them 10 years of really working hard to do this, what I thought should be a fairly simple thing. So I changed my mind and I said, yes, get rid of the land bank. Just if land isn't developed, then it isn't taxable. And so that's the way it ended up. And it was my first really pronounced experience with how slow federal bureaucracy works, how slow. And since then, it's been the same thing. Anything that involves federal bureaucracy takes 10 to 20 years, and it's just a constant battle. And so I've come to recognize that and try to deal with it in other ways. But besides the land bank, the biggest thing that affected us by that time, the Alaska Outdoor Council, was called the QTE, Qualified Transfer Entity. And that was a provision in the 1991 amendments that would have allowed, I can't remember exactly how it worked, but I believe it was, would have allowed Native corporations to transfer their lands to tribes. They were, although it didn't say tribes, they were obviously the only thing that met the definition of qualified transfer entity. And I remember when one of the active members of AOC saw that and brought it to our attention when he read the amendments, the proposed amendments. He was he worked for the IRS as an enforcement agent, in part. But he read that and said to himself, "What is a QTE?" And he brought it to our attention, and we recognized that it was. The only thing that met the definition were the tribal groups. And by that time, there was some dissatisfaction among certain groups with the settlement, with ANCSA, with the claim settlement, and a desire see, in the claim settlement, no tribes received land. It was only corporations. And so there was some effort by that time to get more authority and perhaps land to the tribal entities. So that was our big effort in at that time. And I believe it was at that time, Richard may be able to remember this better, but there was a gubernatorial election, which involved about five major Republican candidates, including, five candidates. There was Arlister Jaluski, Steve Cooper, Dick Randolph, and Somerville.
Somerville.
I think it was then that he ran for governor. And the main reason he ran for governor was to bring attention to this issue. And he did, and he was able to convince the other Republican candidates that this portion of the 1991 amendments should be opposed. And so they did. He didn't come close to winning, but it was a major effort.
So what the Alaska Outdoor Council had the position that they were against this QTE transfer?
Correct.
And why was that something they opposed?
Because it would provide, the way it was stated, and I must confess, I'm not that familiar, I can't bring all up the details, but it basically, as I recall, would put a lot of land in, or had the potential of putting a lot of land into tribal fee ownership, which could then be transferred into trust land, basically given back to the federal government to hold in trust, therefore establishing Indian country. And Indian country is a big issue.
Right.
Because it involves a lot. The primary, from my perspective, the primary issues in Indian country revolve around tax exemption of tax and exemption from state and municipal taxation and state and municipal regulation.
Which in the case of AOC gets into the fish and game world.
Yeah, and generally speaking now when AOC addresses the Indian country issue, they stick to the fish and game issue. I do not represent AOC in my discussions about Indian country, because I taught mainly about taxation regulation, taxation and other issues. But anyway,
I was wondering also if the idea of the corporation land being transferred to tribal, would that create access issues in that it was would no longer be public? But that might be the same or tribal, maybe it wouldn't matter.
It wouldn't matter. Okay. Corporation is not public land, it's private land. And AOC did not object to that at all.
Okay.
And have always supported the trespass restrictions. You know, if you don't want your land to be trespassed on, then fine. That's part of private property.
Okay. Provisions in federal law. 17B access.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Dick brings up a good point. In ANCSA, there was this provision of 17B access.
Across
Native corporation lands that were blocking access to other public or private lands. And 17Bs are, I think, very important. AOC has always thought they were very important. They're difficult. It continues to be a difficult issue.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that relates down to Chitna with the those corporation lands and people crossing their lands to fish.
I don't think 17B is involved in that. I think it's straight ownership there. I'm not positive.
So 17B is just, it's a provision that says the corporation has to allow access across their land to other federal lands,
private,
public lands?
Yeah, other public or private lands that are blocked.
Okay.
But that 17B is a trail that must be provided. And I think there's, you know, I don't know if it's 10 or 20 feet, whatever it is. And they have, it's supposed to be a specific trail and marked, but getting it marked is extremely difficult. I don't think there's any funding for it or anything like that. That's been one of the battles.
Okay.
They seem, I think most of the 17B easements are on a map now, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're
not necessarily identified fully on the ground.
Yeah, they're not identified on the ground. Then one of the things that AOC was really strong in the late 1980s, 1990, we developed a really strong grassroots lobby, recognizing that, yes, it's important to have a professional lobbyist, but the professional lobbyist is not going to be very effective unless there's strong grassroots behind it. And that was one of the things that I worked on in particular. We had phone trees. The fax machine went like crazy. Of course, we didn't have what we have now electronically. And I'm in 1992, I believe, there was an effort to pass a, here we go. There was an effort to pass a, oh, 1990. There was an effort to pass a rural subsistence priority and put it into the state constitution. Because by that time, the McDowell case had passed, and which said that the rural priority was not consistent with the state constitution. And we supported the state constitution. One of our slogans was defend the Constitution, don't amend it, or don't amend the Constitution, defend it.
Defend it, don't amend it.
Defend it, don't amend it. Yeah, making it short. And there was a decision strategically or whatever that because of our relatively small size, outdoor council, although we were pretty effective by that time, we had, I don't know, maybe 40 clubs and at one time 2,000 affiliate or associate members. And which made the easily the 10,000 altogether. We made a strategic decision that trying to the best route for us to go was to oppose the putting the initiative on the ballot. And in order to do that, in order to put it on the ballot, it had to have a 2/3 of the House and 2/3 of the state Senate. So our objective was to not allow that. And it was a tremendous grassroots lobby effort. And the reason that we thought it better, we figured we'd lose if it ever went to the ballot. And that was because, first of all, AOC would be portrayed as being opposed to subsistence, as versus what our real opposition was, which was we were opposed to the nature of the priority. But we were constantly portrayed in the media as opposed to subsistence. And it did not register, I must admit, it did not register in my brain what a difference that made. There were people out in the bush who were genuinely convinced that we were animal rights people, that we were opposed to their hunting and fishing of any nature. We were opposed to subsistence. We were opposed to their taking of fish and game. And that became apparent when we went at one time to talk, Dick and I, to talk to a class at the university. And there was a young fellow there from Chalkeetsik. And he argued with Richard because he was convinced we were animal rights people. And another time we participated in a group sponsored by the local Quaker group, or was it statewide?
Statewide.
Statewide Quakers group, that's right.
With somebody from outside mediating it.
Mm-hmm. And we did several sessions on our own talking about the subsistence priority, and the and then there was a group from
Buckland
that did the same. And eventually the group from Buckland came into Fairbanks and we all met together out off and spent 2 or 3 days together living in a dorm type situation. And they had initially the same impression. We were against their taking of fish and game. And this, I think, created such a tremendous animosity in the rural-urban divide. And it has lasted today. It's just, in my mind, tragic that this misperception was, I don't know if it was fostered by some, my husband is shaking his head yes, or it just accidentally happened. But it was an unnecessary tragic division between urban and rural people. So that was, Yes, Tom.
Yeah, this is Tom. I just wanted to note for Karen, for the record, what Mary's describing, the Quaker process was called Alaskans Listening to Alaskans about Subsistence.
Yes.
So
yes.
If you do a search on that, I believe there may be copies of the tapes at the university library, but you'll be able to find some information to get back to that source.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, and we have a video or two that they took. so that was one of the reasons that we really didn't want for it to go to a public vote, because we would be not portrayed correctly. Another thing was that this thing, which persisted all the time, was that the priority only came into play when there was a real shortage. And the media was permeated with it. There was no recognition of the lawsuits, which said, you know, it was in effect all the time. So we had that to deal with. And then there's always the issue when you're called a racist. And that happened to us personally a few times. I know it happened to other people more than a few times. It's an easy thing to say. It's a hard thing to refute unless you have the confidence in your own personal life experience that you are not a racist. Which we did have. It's a hard thing for people to deal with, to figure out how am I going to deal with people calling me a racist. It's very, very hurtful. So you have to have that confidence in yourself and in your own personal life experience. And when I was called, or when it was obvious that I was being considered to be a racist because of this was a different issue, I explained to the person that I'm quite confident that we're not racists. We had three young women who lived with us as boarding students for 2 years and when we lived in McGrath. And we have still continued good correspondence and good friendships with them. Native young ladies from the village of Nikolai. We've always had a good relationship with the people of Nikolai because of that and because of Richard's experience working with Nikolai men, helping them become guides, and in other relations as well. But those we can point to definitely and talk to people about that. If you don't have that kind of personal life experience, it's more difficult to defend yourself as being a non-racist. It's a easy thing to claim, and it's very hurtful.
And at the time, the rural-urban divide, as you say, it was easy to add racial divisions to that divide.
Terribly easily. Yes, that was it.
And it was a poison pen for politicians.
Yep. As Richard says, it's a poison pen for a politician. If a politician gets labeled as a racist, I mean, what is he going to do if he doesn't have... I mean, what do? Do you explain something like I just explained? Maybe you don't have those kinds of life experiences, but it's so easy to call somebody a racist just because they don't agree with you.
Yeah. And as you say, the focus was maybe a more rural urban in the debates on the subsistence priority, but it, as with many issues, they get conflated and
yes.
The way the population was split in that time period.
Yes, very much so.
Now it's a little bit more mixed, but so that was the subsistence priority, that issue that AOC was very involved in.
Yes, and we really urged our, through our grassroots lobbying, we wanted to avoid this two-thirds positive in the House and 2/3 positive in the Senate. I believe we lost in the House. I think the House came out 2/3, but we won in the Senate, so it did not go on to the ballot. And that was, those are the main issues that we dealt with during the 1980s. But we also did quite a bit of, you might call, administrative work with developing and improving the bylaws and with what we called our policy book. And we developed a number of policies, and they were passed at the annual meetings. And that's what I've been looking for here. I can't find our policy book. But it involved general statements with regard to the Board of Fish, the Board of Game, some hatchery issues, predator prey.
Public access.
Public access was a big issue. Just a lot of...
state navigable
waters. Oh, navigable waters was definitely part of it. I can't remember. There was hatcheries. There was general statements on a number of things that we still go back to.
Yeah, well, and I think by looking through some of the more recent newsletters that are available online on the website, it looks like they kind of put those in the newsletter. Like, this is the issue and that we're working on and our perspective on it. Because some of those same issues, they're mentioned in some of those newsletters.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's the same things now that was going on in 1982, 83.
That's what I was going to say. When you listed the main issues from that first 1983 meeting, I'm like, oh, well, that one, they're all still going on.
They're still going on, yes.
You mentioned your tenure as editor of...
Oh, yes, and I was... I was on that initial Sportsman's Council board for a very short time. And then when it reorganized and went down to 7 board members, I got off the board. And the new board members, I should read you the names of the new board members. Here, the headline in 85 was Council Requests Alaskan Hearings on Proposed ANCSA Amendments. So that was part of the sort of thing we were doing. And I believe the initial ALC board members were Eddie Grasser from Palmer, who's now
Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation.
Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation. Sam Harbo, who was Emeritus Professor in Biology and Statistics. Warren Hofflick from Anchorage. I don't remember him very well, I'm sad to say. Lyle Carlson, who was an attorney here, and involved with navigable waters lawsuits. And he was also a Delta barley farmer and a really neat guy and tragically killed in a farming accident. Ron Swanson, who was with DNR and involved in navigable waters, I believe. Robert Rausch, who was with Fish and Game in Juneau. And Luke Andrews, who was also with fisheries,
sport fish
in out of Juneau. So
even if they were a Fish and Game employee, they could be on the AOC board?
At that time, yes. I'm not too sure they can anymore.
Well, it got tighter later on, and then it's kind of loosened up again, I think.
Tom might be able to comment on that.
Well, I think...
You know, I don't know. I know any time that a state employee serves in any capacity with an organization, even as a volunteer, they have to declare it to the state. So some of it has to do with conflict of interest or compensation, so I'm not sure, but for sure, that I knew they do have to declare it. I just don't know how much approval and how high up they need that to have policymaking authority.
So you don't, it might be able to be like a board on the board of directors of an organization?
Yes, you can for certain things, like for Wildlife Society, I know we can, but it is case specific. And when you get involved with policymaking, there could be a conflict of interest, like having someone from the administration sit on a Fish and Game Foundation board. If they work for the Department of Fish and Game and set policy, that could be a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think Dick said before that when he worked for Fish and Game, he was not as active in AOC as after he retired.
Correct.
That's right.
Very, very true.
So, Mary, quickly, because I have some other questions for that Dick might be wanting to talk about, but you were the newsletter editor.
Yes, until 1992. I just found my resignation letter. But I did come back and do a few issues after that. And I think I was pretty much volunteer until 92. And then I think I got paid $500 an issue when I did them after that.
Oh, you got paid. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I got paid then.
So can you talk a little bit about what that entailed, being the newsletter editor in those early days?
Well, I tried to attend every board of directors meeting to keep up with what the important decisions were. And the initial meetings, of course, we didn't have Zoom meetings or anything like that. It was pretty expensive, I remember, because they were telephonic, and we would somehow or other, the telephone people would join us all up together, and there would be a meeting for an hour or two. And this was a fairly expensive part of our budget. And I remember that we would often meet at Bud and Sally Burris's home here in Fairbanks. And there would be Lyle Carlson and Sam Harbo and Bud Burris and maybe a few others. For a while, Bud was president of the AOC. So I attended those. I worked a lot with the help of Dick Burley, who had the commercial printing at the time and was a member of the that initial group, the Interior Alaska Wildlife Association, along with Wagaman and Stroker. And he gave me a lot of help. He was a printer, and I remember one bit of advice he said, "Mary, you're a quarterly, you're not a daily. You cannot keep up with things on a daily basis. Don't try." he was the first one that got me going with digital. I think I had a Capro computer a long time ago. Fortunately, I had a son who knew something about computers, and that was of some help. Let's see. Oh, what else? It was just a matter of putting... I really tried to emphasize education about sportsmen's role in the past, and in particular, like the 1937 Pittman-Robertson Act, and how valuable that movement was in 1937. We always remembered it because we were born, Dick and I were both born in 1937 too, so it was a great year. And so education on Hunter's value to conservation was one of the main things I tried to push. There was plenty of examples there. It was the hunters that brought back wild turkey. They brought back too many deer. They brought back several species from, you know, really threatened status. And some people said it's too bad some of these dicky birds aren't edible because they could be hunted and they would be safeguarded because the hunters would be protecting them. So that was my.
Did you write all the articles, or did you get other people to write?
There were other people that wrote. The executive director, which was primarily Somerville at that time, always wrote an article or two. I would ask for guest writers, in particular on certain issues that they were familiar with. So I wrote everyone that was not, that didn't have an author at the top.
And what was I just going to say? Oh, did biologists like from Fish and Game write reports about species and status and population regulations, things like
sometimes,
that?
Sometimes, I can't remember. Now, who's Bill Martin? He's employee of Anchorage, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Okay, here's one that is written by somebody with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There's just lots of little news and tidbits type things.
It's sort of like statewide tidbits of what's happening with the different clubs and things.
Right, yeah, I would always try and have something about a club. Here's one on, here's one by Bob Ely on the Yukon Quest. Here's one on raffles by Warren Olson, who was one of the board members. So there was a variety. I would try and get other people to write articles. Believe me, I did not need to fill out. And it went from a four-page one sheet to eight-page. What's that? Two sheets, two big sheets. It might have even been, a few times been bigger. And it was fun. I remember watching the first time it went off. The News Miner press rolls, watching the thing that I had produced going around and around and around on these big press rolls on the newspaper sheet.
Cool. And we should say that I think most of those are archived at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Rasmussen Library. I think I found that they do have them.
Good. I was hoping they did.
And then since about 2005, I found ones on the AOC's website.
Yes. I don't know. You know, this issue of subsistence complications, I don't know if I can show this or not. And it may never
It's a cartoon.
It's a cartoon by Dunlap Scholl. It was published in the Anchorage.
Peter Dunlap Scholl.
Scholl?
Peter Dunlap Scholz.
Peter Dunlap Scholz. Okay. It was published in the Anchorage Daily News. And it's got two angels sitting on clouds here with their halos and their harps, and one's on a phone. And it says, subsistence must be getting really complicated. Alaska wants to know if man's dominion over the animals can be handed back to God. And he had another one that we don't have a copy of right now, and it shows Noah's Ark and all the animals in pairs coming up on Noah's Ark. And the caption under it was, if AOC was
God, it shows him throwing the wolves overboard.
It shows him throwing the wolves overboard. There would be no wolves on Noah's Ark. And Richard called up the cartoonists and suggested to him that no, Noah would have left one on the Ark. So fortunately, there were some times of humor.
Well, and that was probably another big issue that AOC was involved with, would have been wolf control.
Oh, and how?
Yes.
And that's where Dick gets back into it.
Okay.
And but there were, early on, there was one of the policies was to support predator-prey management and a recognition of this well-documented monologue. Is that what it's called?
Monograph. By Bill
Gassaway.
Right.
It was published by the Wildlife Society in when?
I don't remember. Tom.
Maybe in the late 70s?
No, it was later than that.
Oh, okay.
There were two monographs. One was 1983, and that was primarily describing moose-wolf interactions in Unit 20A. But the one that really was probably more instrumental for the intensive management law was the 1992 monograph that looked at case histories from around Alaska and Yukon to illustrate the effectiveness of reducing predator densities to enhance harvestable surplus of moose.
And that was by Gassaway as well?
Yes, he was the lead author.
Okay. Okay.
So, Mary, after you were, did you ever become a board member for the AOC?
No, I never did. I never ran for the board. Richard did.
Right.
But
you were busy with the newsletter.
I was quite busy with the newsletter, and I liked doing it, but it was incredibly time consuming.
Yeah. Quickly, how many other women were involved in the organization?
Well, some of the women I specifically remember, Sue Ensminger. Her husband is Frank Ensminger, the sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
They're from out of Tok.
Right.
Yeah, Tok.
And Madge Kelly House, she was very instrumental in helping revise our policy book so that it made some sense. Mike Dalton was a big help. We had this is another bit of history. We had annual fundraisers in Fairbanks, and then they also began in Wasilla and Juneau. But our annual fundraisers in Fairbanks were incredible. You're familiar with HIPOW for the Monroe Foundation, Happiness is Paying Our Way. It was, in a way, they were patterned after HIPOW, but we called them LOPOW. they started out in the Eagles Hall. The first one, it was maybe 1983 or 4.
It was 83.
And we were so pleased. We had no idea what was going to happen. And it was, you know, donations, and then you had an auctioneer, and you had some on silent auction, you had some on oral auction. That first, I think it was the first one. It was in the Eagles Hall, and it was very cold. And we didn't have pre-sold tickets at that time. You bought your ticket at the door for the most part. And there was a lineup that went way, way out the door and into the snow. It was very successful, we thought. I think we made $10,000 profit on that night. And then it just grew from there. We just simply outgrew the Eagles Hall. And we moved with a lot of help with from Rick Shakora, who is a very active member. We moved into the Monroe Gym, and we often had it a week or two following High Pow, and they left the decorations up for us. And so we added a few more decorations, and we didn't run it the same way, but it was an oral auction and a silent auction. It just grew bigger and bigger every year. And we had to go to pre-sold tickets, and we sold out at roughly 525 tickets for several years in a row. People would sometimes get very angry that they couldn't get in, but all the tickets were sold. And we had to go to pre-assigned seating. It became very difficult, and I was in charge of difficult to manage in a way, sort of fun in a way, because it was so successful. I was in charge of the volunteers, and I kept track of them. And we had over 100 volunteers for several years in a row at that event. So we had 100 volunteers and 525 attending. It was a big effort and very successful. And Mike Dalton was very, very involved in that, and a whole different group of volunteers, just local people who enjoyed doing it. They were unhappy that we no longer have this, but it's such an immense effort. Yes.
And so did you also serve a meal?
Yes, there was a meal.
Was it wild game?
What we did was we couldn't charge for wild game. So we served wild game hors d'oeuvres before the meal. And they were very popular. And we had Wheezy's provided blueberry juice. I can't remember which call it, but it was, blueberry stuff. And people just brought smoked fish and stuff made from wild game and fish.
Pickled
white fish was a favorite. That was
salmon.
And Bud Wheezy's pickled white fish, smoked salmon. And that always went fast. That was put out first up near the stage on a couple tables. And then the meal was served. One or two years we had a buffet that did not go well, so we switched to a served meal. And the pump house, we bought the meal from the pump house, and I believe we used their servers too. We did. Okay. And that was, I don't remember what the meals were.
I asked about the wild game because I know Dave Klein talked about when he was at the university, the Wildlife Club would have a wild game dinner every year.
Oh, yes. And that was popular. And we would go to those too. Yeah. Yes.
So the money that was made in these fundraisers, how was that money used?
That went to run the Outdoor Council. It paid whatever staff. At first, it started out with just the executive director, Ron Somerville. Then he had to hire somebody to keep track of the membership and the bookkeeping. And that somebody was down in Juneau. And then
eventually hired a lobbyist.
Eventually, right.
Then we hired a paid lobbyist later on. When I was most active. The executive director was Jesse van der Zanden, and he actually lived here in Fairbanks, and the main office was here in Fairbanks. That was in the 90s?
Yeah.
At that time, Jesse was executive director. He hired a bookkeeper.
Part-time.
She took care of the books and the membership.
Mm-hmm.
So there was Jesse, the books and membership person, and a hired lobbyist.
Okay. And then also your membership dues helped pay for these kinds of parts of the organization also, right?
Sure. Sure. Yeah,
the
newsletter, whatever we put out as a newsletter, it was paid. The money went into the council, the 501c4, and also into the fund, the 501c3. And our fundraiser up here in Fairbanks was always for the fund. And so the money we raised went to that effort, which was used in litigation and research and
education.
The other fundraisers were for the council, as I recall.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the executive director is paid from both because it involves both. And the newsletter is paid from both because there's issues from both.
So the 501c3 that you're talking about, is that now what's called the Alaska Trust Fund, something like that?
No. There's the Alaska Outdoor Council and the Alaska Fish and Wildlife Conservation Fund. And under the Alaska, this gets complicated. Under the fund, there is the
Alaska Trust Fund.
The Alaska Trust Fund.
Yeah, because I saw that in the newsletters and Dick's in your name associated with it. So I was wondering what that was.
That's not been very active in the last 10 years. and it was designed to be an endowment fund.
Okay. So that was set up separately.
Yes, it was set up separately under the 501c3.
And that would be an endowment to keep funding the council and its activities?
And the fund and its activities, yes.
So the fund still exists, the larger conservation fund still exists?
Oh, very definitely.
Okay.
And it's used like organization put a lot of money toward the Sturgeon case, and that money came from the fund and largely from the efforts of the Fairbanks dinner auction.
It was included as part of the program. It had nothing to do with the admission or cost to attend the banquet, but it was a big solicitation day at that time.
Right. And yes,
so you would have maybe Sturgeon came and spoke to the group or something.
I can't remember, but I think he did. And as a matter of fact, now he is on the board of AOC. And the fund. The board of AOC is the same as the board of the fund, except the fund has one or two more members.
There are trustees under that trustee.
Okay.
Yeah, are they called trustees of the fund?
They're members of the Alaska Trust Fund, which is set up under the Conservation Fund.
Right. The trust fund people are called trustees.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, it's confusing. Everybody having the same fund word.
It is confusing.
Okay. Well, that's a great history, Mary. Thank you.
You bet.
Dick, did you have some other things you wanted to talk about with your role? Because you you were president and on the board for a long time.
Yeah, after after I left Fish and Game, about the first thing that happened was we ran out of anybody for the executive director, and so I volunteered to do that at a reduced rate. It's kind of to fill in the blanks until somebody else could be hired on a presumably permanent basis. So I did that for, I don't know, several months, I guess, at least. And basically at no cost to the council or the fund. Mm-hmm. And then we got somebody hired for the executive director position. I think it was, Randy Smith, who was from Anchorage. And at that time, we did not yet have a paid lobbyist in Juneau. So I got into the lobbying business. And I guess to sort of look back a little bit, the McDowell suit came about as a result of the state legislature amending state law to include a rural priority in state law, which it previously did not have. And a lawsuit was almost immediately filed, and it became known as the McDowell suit, named after Sam McDowell, who was a longtime tenacious critical reviewer of fisheries management, principally a sport fish advocate, and he was always concerned about overharvest by commercial fisheries. So he and several others, Warren Olson and a couple others, a guy named Eastman, I think, and I think there was a fourth one, Dale Bondurant, who was a really unique character, got together and filed a lawsuit against the rural priority in state law. That became the McDowell suit, which in 1989, the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that the rural priority was not constitutional. And so that threw that provision of the law out. The issue came up whether that provision, the rural priority, was separable from the rest of the law. And I guess it would be a Superior Court state judge. Now I can't remember her name. She became she was appointed to the Supreme Court and just retired a year or two ago. Anyway.
Yeah, Dana.
Fabe.
Oh, I can't.
Wasn't it?
McCabe, is that it?
Fabe, F-A-B-E,
oh, yeah,
I think.
Fabe, yeah. I was going to say, I don't know what Mary is doing there in the background. She's pouring water or something, and whatever she does in the background makes noise. I know it's hard for you to just sit and listen, but... it comes up on the recording.
That's a characteristic of our house. Sometimes we pour water rather than turn on a faucet. Anyway, of course.
So you got involved as the lobbyist and for AOC as a volunteer, and you were probably working very hard on the subsistence issue then.
The subsistence issue predominated the Alaska Outdoor Council's activities for several years. There were other issues going on that we also addressed in the legislature. But there was a litany of lawsuits that commenced. Actually, some, I guess, had preceded McDowell, but commenced, and a lot of political activity, a lot of contentious issues. Immediately after the McDowell decision, Governor Cooper decided to introduce or try to get introduced a resolution for a constitutional amendment to put rural in the Constitution. And that was that we were completely involved in that to the extent, both Mary and I, to the extent that in a sort of a moment of wry humor, we would occasionally say that our kids were subsistence orphans because each of both of us were spending so much time on that issue that it seemed like we were neglecting our kids. So that went on, and there were lawsuits. There was proposed lawsuits by the state to modify provisions of federal law or to take issue with them. And this was kind of a running gun battle. Finally, and there were Senator Stevens in particular was trying to negotiate some peace, I guess you could say, some way to bring the sides together. And he got a delay in the implementation of federal regulations, which was a threat at the time, that if the state did not conform to the federal law by a certain date, and I think it was, I forget, early 90s, the feds would take over, preempt state management on federal lands. And there was both lawsuits and political maneuvering about that. And then finally, the legislature sort of dumped the issue onto the boards of fish and boards of game and said, you solve it. Come up with something that satisfies federal law and is within the bounds of the Alaska Constitution. So they sweat blood and tears over that for quite a while. I remember so well that Sidney Huntington couldn't sleep at night over that because he had a great empathy for Native people, of which he was one in part. And at the same time, he had a fierce sense of justice. And it just tore him up. So that went on, and the board did finally agree on some provisions that seemed to pave the way, but basically they still did not comply with Title VIII of ANILCA. And so eventually, I think it was in 1999, that the federal government issued regulations for managing fishing game on federal lands. And that in itself was controversial for a number of reasons, not the least, well, some sort of in general terms, like provisions also of Title VIII that said nothing was to diminish the state's authority to manage resident fish and wildlife. Also the matter of state navigable waters, which had sort of been buried or lost or something in the course of all this controversy, but still was unsettled. And as it came out, you know, much later on, there were issues of that, one of which led to the Sturgeon case, because John Sturgeon, now going on 14 or 15 years ago, said, well, ANILCA says that the federal laws, the federal law ANILCA in Title VIII says it applies to federal public land. And state navigable waters are not federal public land. And so he took it to court. It took him quite a while to get there. It took him, I think, 7 years before he actually decided to pursue it in court, during which time he had attempted to negotiate with the Park Service and get a mutual understanding of what the law meant. And finally it was fruitless, and so he decided to file suit. So there was a lot of this stuff going on. Well, there were two or three. Go ahead.
I was going to say, the way that the subsistence issue finally has been resolved, or at least resolved for the moment, how do you feel about that? Are you satisfied with the way it's all played out, or you'd like to see something different? Uh-oh. Did we lose you? Did you freeze up?
I've still got you, Karen. It's Tom.
Yeah, Dick is frozen. I don't know if he can hear me. Dick, can you hear me? Your Zoom has frozen. You might need to log back in and try again.
Oh, now you're back.
Okay, yeah. So I will ask my question again because we did not hear your answer.
Okay.
So my question was that you said in 1999 the federal regulations were set up. And so since then, I don't know if we can say the subsistence issue has been resolved, but as it stands now, how do you feel about the current situation? Are you satisfied with the way it's all played out, or would you like to see something different?
Well, the short answer is it's still a mess.
Right.
Because there is dual management, in a sense, that the federal agencies feel some responsibility to regulate activities. The rural priority for subsistence uses of wild renewable resources still pertains at all times on all federal lands. So the exceptions to that, I think, include federal lands such as Fort Wayne lands across the river and 28 and things like that. But And in the course of events over, 40 years in total, 20 years approximately 20 years since McDowell, I guess that's going on 30, it's been very difficult for the state to come to terms with the administration of ANILCA with regard to the management of fish and game. And so you have things popping up like the National Park Service issuing regulations that prohibited certain kinds of taking of wildlife under state regulations on preserves. Well, that was brought to the attention of Congress, and Congress used the Congressional Review Act to revoke those regulations. Similar regulations had earlier been enacted by the Fish and Wildlife Service, but the time frame in which the Congressional Review Act could be applied passed before those could be addressed. So things like that, and there's been innumerable, what one authority on ANILCA, probably one of the best authorities in the state or anywhere, Tina Cunning, has summarized in a long paper entitled Erosion. And what it amounts to is numerous examples of where the administration of the federal law has been fast and loose in many cases, including simply ignoring provisions of Title VIII or passing regulations that don't comport. Classic example being the sturgeon case again, and so on. So it's a constant difficulty. So it's not satisfactory. It sort of works, and there's a certain amount of collaboration between field people in federal agencies and the state. But when it comes to decisions by the Federal Subsistence Board, which is responsible for making the regulations governing the the administration of federal rules on federal lands, it's a crapshoot. And Mary's got something she wants to add.
The question about non-local hunters in Northwest Alaska and caribou, and the caribou, I think it was down in the Aleutians where the population was almost gone, but they wouldn't have predator control.
Yeah, when you brought up, I think I may have mentioned it before, but in 2016, non-local hunters were excluded from hunting portions of the Western Arctic caribou herd at a time when the Western Arctic herd had declined significantly. And as it turns out, the state objected to it, but because there were so few non-local hunters in relation to the harvestable surplus, that it was immaterial to both the well-being of the herd and the opportunities of local people. The most recent example was the Federal Subsistence Board closing federal lands along the Richardson and Denali highways to non-local hunters on the premise that it was principally a public safety matter, which there is a provision for in ANILCA, but it was a pretty shaky case from all accounts, and also to ensure that subsistence uses by federally qualified hunters would not be threatened on caribou in particular and moose in that area. So there have been things like that. And what's happened more in recent years, in my perspective, is that the Federal Subsistence Board has gone to less of individual manipulation of seasons, bag limits, and that sort of thing, and more to sweeping concepts such as precluding non-local hunters in Northwest Alaska and this Unit 13 thing along the Richardson Highway, and also the Arctic Village sheep management area, where I actually proposed that it be opened again because it was so little used by local people. And the Federal Subsistence Board said, no, we're not going to open it up. It's going to stay closed to ensure that it doesn't, the change that cultural values would not be threatened by such a change. So those measures are sweeping, is the word that always comes to mind. Addressing things on a broad scope rather than looking at the particulars of the situation.
Well, it sounds to me like you said, bag limits and seasons. That's approaching it from a specific herd or population of the animals versus the examples you're giving are these broad actions against the humans.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Kind of where you're prioritizing. When did your involvement with the AOC decline or stop? I mean, you were on the board and the president until 2005, 2006. Somewhere around there?
And during that time, I also did, going back a little earlier, there are a couple events that occurred. I was on Governor Hickel's Subsistence Advisory body, I think it was called a council or might have been a commission. And that was a group of people drawn from different elements of Alaska's population, included natives, commercial fishermen, et cetera, et cetera. And the first year that that was instituted under Hickel's advice, I was not on it, and the body was unable to resolve, to come up with proposed resolutions to what Hickel's goal was to create in state law, without amending the Constitution, a regulatory regime that would meet the needs of the usual protagonists, rural subsistence users and other Alaskans. And that's what, he was the eternal optimist. He thought if people would just get together and talk about this, they could do it. Well, the first round, the first session, I think, encompassed most of the winter, maybe most of the year. They were unable to do that. They reconvened the following year. And I mentioned to the governor that I thought he had a good body, but he lacked the representation of sport hunters. And I used that term kind of loosely, but deliberately, to connote the average non-rural hunter in Alaska, sport hunters abroad label that's often used that way. And I said, can't you add a representation? He said, he turned to Charlie Call, his attorney general, and said, is there any reason we can't do that? And Charlie said, no, no reason that I know of. So he said, okay, we'll do it. Give us a name. Well, I turned out to be the name, which was very interesting. On that panel was Mitch Dementoff, Jay Hammond, Eric Farr, Matthew Aya from Nome was on it for a while, but I think he was in bad health. He had to get off. And let's see, there were a couple others that I don't remember now. Anyway, it was a pretty good group. Well, there's a fellow from the Cook Inlet Drift Netters Association, who was also a very interesting person. Anyway, we got into it and managed to, with the intensive assistance of Mackay Campbell, who was an aide to Governor Hickel, we managed to put together the basics for a statute which Governor Hickel proposed to the legislature. And one of the sticking points, and I've got it here somewhere, how would culture be recognized in this law? How could it be recognized and accommodated in this law? And what it came down to, and Governor Hammond had a great quote about it, is, you know, it's an important element, but it is just not something that's easily translated into regulation. And so we went round and round on that for quite a while. And finally, I don't know, Mary, can you search through the paper sitting over there and find those findings? I think they're out here somewhere.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
The findings from Hickel's commission. It's.
I have this.
Yeah. Well, that's later. But. Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Anyway, in order to get past that hurdle, I developed some language that would go in the findings for the law that Hickel would introduce. And this is a partial quote. We are talking about, quote, Alaskans, both native and non-native, who have a traditional social or cultural relationship to and reliance upon the wild, renewable resources produced by Alaskan land and water. And although customs, traditions, and beliefs vary, these Alaskans share ideals of respect for nature, the importance of using resources wisely, and the value and dignity of a way of life in which they use Alaska's fish and wildlife for a substantial portion of their sustenance. This way of life is recognized as subsistence. These uses are culturally, socially, spiritually, and nutritionally important and provide a sense of identity for many subsistence users. And that, plus some other accessory language that spell out the details and kind of made it official, went into the findings of the 1992 law that ultimately did pass the legislature after first being rejected by the first time around. So anyway, that was kind of an important moment for me. And I think for the state, because the state law was successfully amended and it did direct the effort to make it possible to have rules that accommodated subsistence uses, whether you justifying them on the basis of use and need, but not ignoring the cultural aspects. So it was a step in the right direction. One other later event that I would mention just in association with my involvement with the AOC was that there were continuing efforts to amend the Constitution, put a rural priority into it. And they basically culminated with Governor Knowles' efforts after he had refused to appeal the Katie John case further and take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. He still persisted in trying to promote a constitutional rural subsistence priority amendment. And in the context of lobbying, and I can't remember now if I was the official lobbyist or just as president or something else at the time, I spent a lot of time on that. And ultimately, Governor Knowles' last shot at it was in 2001 when he convened a stage show in Anchorage called the Governor's Subsistence Summit, in which he invited somewhere in the order of 30 or 40 people, most of whom he carefully selected to having agreed with his wish to get a rural subsistence priority in the Constitution. But he did have two minority members, Ron Somerville and myself. And mentioning Somerville again, it was his, going way back to the reorganization of AOC, it was his insight that the overreach or oversight of federal management was going to be a huge difficulty for the state and its execution of its responsibilities and authorities if it went into place in its entirety, and in particular, the subsistence priority. And that is really what stimulated him to encourage the reorganization of the old Alaska Wildlife Federation into the Alaska Outdoor Council. And he gives a lot of credit, I talked to him recently, he gives a lot of credit to the efforts of Bill Waugman of Fairbanks in providing the funding to get it off the ground. But at any rate, he and I were the two minority members on that panel of Knowles in 2001. And the panel
did as he planned and supported amending the Constitution. But it never caught fire in the legislature, although there was a lot of work on it. And so a resolution was never passed by the legislature to do that. And there are two quotes that I remember as being wonderful one-liners with regard to the rural subsistence priority. The first one was by Senator Gary Wilkin from Fairbanks, who sat through several years of the debates about a subsistence priority. And he just said, you don't vote away your civil rights, because by then it was very clearly coming from all the way back from the McDowell case that it was indeed a civil rights issue. In the reverse of the usual civil rights issues. And the other quote came from a lawyer from the Kenai who had functioned a lot in fish matters, mainly for commercial fishermen. And now his name again escapes me. He's a black man, and he's testified somewhere in the middle of one of these debates. He said, I oppose the rural subsistence priority. If it passes, it will violate my civil rights. I'm a black man. I know about civil rights, and this would violate mine. And I thought, boy, you can't get much stronger testimony than that. And those two one-liners have stuck with me. There are a lot of other things that went on. And I would just say in the context, you know, the difficult context of this, there were some other things that went on. When the Katie John case first came up, and then Ninth Circuit Court said, yes, the feds have the authority to regulate fishing in the Copper River because it's federal reserve waters, because it's right on the edge of the national park, and that the federal government has a right to manage what goes on there. So that was a sort of a defining moment for the direction that federal management took. But it also involved a preemption of what was clearly stated going all the way back to the Federal Submerged Lands Act, that states have the authority under federal law to own the bed of submerged lands and tidelands, submerged lands under navigable waters and tidelands. And that was included in the Alaska Statehood Act, and the issue in the Katie John was clearly a case of whether that prevailed or whether the Reserved Waters Act prevailed. Governor Knowles first said, I'm bound as governor to defend the sovereignty of the state over navigable waters, and just as any governor would do in any state. Then ultimately, he changed his mind after he was aggressively attacked politically by AFN and others, saying, if you do that, if you take that on to the Supreme Court, you're dead meat politically. We'll oppose you with everything we got. And his last quote on it, which came out in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, said, I've decided that I can't do in court what I don't believe in my heart. And he backed off and did not appeal it. In fact, he dismissed it with prejudice so that it could not come up again.
What does it mean when you dismiss something with prejudice?
You relinquish the right to bring it up again.
So the state can never bring it up again. Right. An individual can, but the state cannot.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's why Sturgeon could, but the state could not. You know, and Sturgeon understood that. So, you know, there's a lot of duplicity involved in many of the things that were done.
Well, it's a very complicated issue, that's for sure.
And I guess, you know, after that, I was president of AOC for a little while longer. We had some issues about access. DNR got into regulating access on the Rex Trail. And I, as president, said, well, you did the right thing to regulate it because it's really a hell of a mess, but you didn't do it the right way. But those restrictions stuck, and a lot of people in AOC didn't like the action I took, and eventually it led to my getting off the board, and I declined to run for president again, offered to stay on the board, but I was not reelected. So I quoted Martin Luther King Jr. I said, thank God, free at last, free at last. Unfortunately, that turned out not to be true, and that's why we're here talking to you today.
Well, you left a legacy, that's for sure. And that's one of my questions is for both of you, what you think the greatest contribution that either you have made in reference to some of these issues, or the greatest contribution of the Outdoor Council statewide?
Well, I think the council was instrumental in many things. There's really quite a laundry list, but in terms of what I think is the predominant issue of a rural subsistence priority, I think they're instrumental in preventing the passage of a legislative resolution authorizing an initiative on a rural subsistence priority constitutional amendment. I think it's important to keep in mind that is part of the larger issue of equality and civil rights fairness under state law. And I'm really glad, as messy as it is in terms of fish and game management, I'm really glad that that principle survived this law. In terms of my personal gratification, about the last round, I guess, that I was involved in, when there was, I guess it was Noel's last effort to promote a constitutional amendment on subsistence. So the legislature slogged through it again, and it didn't pass. And it was late in the evening in Juneau at the Capitol, and I came out the door and heaved a big sigh of relief. And an acquaintance of mine who had once been my mortal political enemy said to me, "Well, Dick, looks like you won this round." And I thought, coming from him, that was about as big a compliment as I could get. And Mary's got something to throw in there.
I'm just going to add a local bit. One of the things AOC did was support lands on occasion being put into some kind of a protected state status. And that included, I don't know, a number of critical habitat places, but also just here at home, the Gold Stream Valley public use area. That was an issue of that AOC, as he took on, as I recall, and I remember in particular when Arla Sturjalewski came up, she was rules chairman, and she came up and Fairbanks and I gave her a tour of the Goldstream public use area potential, and she looked at it and thought that was pretty good, and she put it on the docket, and so it passed.
You remember who initiated the idea?
I think it was Mike Davis and you.
It was me.
Okay.
Goldstream Valley was potentially going to get plastered with housing, but it was lousy land for that.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's not very good land for housing down there.
Yeah,
sure is.
So I came up with the idea of a public use area, which was tailored after one that had previously been established in the Nelchina Basin country. And I asked our neighbor, Mike Davis, who was in the House at that time, if he would introduce a bill to put the available vacant state land in Goldstream Valley into a public use area. And he said, sure. So he did. And it took a couple of years, I guess, in the legislature. But it finally passed with a sunset provision on it of, I think it was
10 years,
either 10 or 20 years. I think it was 10 years, and it got renewed with a sunset provision, and when it came up with 20 years, then Senator Joe Thomas agreed to put in a bill to have the sunset provision removed so that it would be permanent. And that happened. And so that was, and AOC did support that. But as Mary said, they supported several critical habitats, some state refuges, state recreational rivers, and the identification and establishment of trails, whether they were ones in contention on federal lands or not. So, and the other thing was, we lobbied heavily on getting a constitutional amendment to specify the individual right to keep and bear arms in the Alaska Constitution. And I was still lobbying at the time, and did lobby on that issue as well, which passed. Right. And passed the public vote.
Well,
so,
go ahead.
I'm sorry?
I was saying, I interrupted you, but go ahead. You were going to finish a thought.
No, I think, I guess, I was going to say end of story.
Oh.
Of course, it's not the end of the story at all. Many of these things are still going on, and they're liable to get, now with the change of federal administration, they're liable to become more complicated again.
Right. Well, I was going to say the idea of a public use area gets me thinking about up along the Steis Highway. Maybe that's something we can throw out there as an idea to do something about that state land up there.
Yeah, it might be, you know.
The public use areas were, it disallowed private ownership, but it did not disallow any really activity, including trapping, mining, all kinds of stuff. That was...
Yeah. Right. But a critical habitat area, I've thought about that might control some of how it's used, and not just if it's land ownership, but
might be
a better protection level.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that gets a little dicey, because it has to come down to something that really is critical, not just either convenient or supplementary to the well-being of the wildlife population.
Right. Like if it was the 40 miles calving ground, that would be an obvious critical habitat, perhaps. But
yeah, and I think
they changed calving every
once
in a
while. I mean, that's just, if there was something you could pinpoint like that.
Yeah. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, but I think the calving area of the 40 mile herd
is still pretty much in the Yukon Charley Preserve.
Yeah, it's not so along the Steese, I know that much.
There is a level of protection in that regard. So anyway, it's lots of other odds and ends to the story, but it's probably, your cup may be running over.
Well, I was thinking your guy's cup, you're the ones who are doing all the talking, but so how do you both feel about having been involved with the Alaska Outdoor Council and all these issues for all these years?
Well, it's interesting because I think I started out as kind of a non-joiner, but some of these issues, particularly as they related to my principal personal values and interests, which mostly rotated around fishing, hunting, trapping, and actually the subsistence lifestyle, the idea, the principle of the ability of people to, through their own efforts, live to a large extent off the land, really drew me into these issues. And I just felt it was really important, but it was also really important to get past the hype and recognize that those values are not unique to necessarily any particular segment of Alaska's population or other states' populations, but they're really kind of fundamental values that contribute to self-respect and self-esteem and should not be restricted from a larger element of the public. But I have to recognize that within that larger element of the public, there's a lot of people that don't place as much value on those, or don't believe as strongly in those values of self-betterment, self-respect, self-responsibility. And that's really unfortunate because it diminishes the image of those who promote it.
I can't remember what the question was, but I think I am.
how you feel about your role in the Alaska Outdoor Council and the work they did and those issues?
Well, I grew up in a hunting and fishing family, very much in Wisconsin. And I also grew up with friends and family who were gay and lesbian. And I came to really believe in the importance of I don't know if you can call it equality, but non-discrimination. And so this sentence that I have used in the past, when equality is not the standard, how much inequality is justifiable? That just really hits me strong. And I see it so important in this subsistence issue and in all issues that involve what you might call minority rights or minority privileges, however you want to put it. So I can become very strongly involved in issues of that nature. And then I mix it up with the fish and game values, and it just goes plop in my lap.
One more quote from Tony Knowles' 2001 Subsistence Summit
people were going around with their comments around the big table, and I made some comment about the importance of equality and the opportunity to use fish and game resources. And next to me was sitting then, I think, Representative Ethan Berkowitz. And he said, he took a deep breath and had a significant pause before he spoke and said, if it's a question of equality or justice, I would choose justice. And I thought to myself, how in the hell do you have justice if you don't start with equality? And I'm still puzzling over that.
Well, that's a very good sentiment for today's day and age as well.
Yeah.
And all that's going on in our world. Well, Tom, did you have any other questions or thoughts?
No, not really. I certainly learned a lot. I knew some of the history, but it was, especially the early years, it was very instructive to hear from Mary and then, you know, some of Dick's recent comments about various things that he experienced and when his participation on that. There was one thing that Dick mentioned that I just wanted to, I think I needed to reverse something where he said that the Park Service regulations on predator take were overturned when the Trump administration came in. I think that was actually the Fish and Wildlife Service federal regulations got overturned. The Park Service still stood, and I think they were just challenged in a court case and upheld this past summer. So I just wanted to, it's just a minor correction. If somebody's listening to this years from now and is puzzled over that and goes looking for it, I think that was the what he meant to say.
Well, I'm not sure I agree, Tom. I think it was the National Park Service regulations on preserves that were overturned under the Congressional Review Act. They might have addressed the Fish and Wildlife Service ones, but the time frame had passed on their opportunity to do so.
What I remember is that the Park Service regulations were passed midway in the Obama administration, and so they couldn't be overturned by the next administration. But the Fish and Wildlife Service regulations on predator take, they were passed late in the Obama administration, like in October, and so the Trump administration was able to overturn them by executive order. So maybe I misunderstood what you were describing.
It wasn't an executive order, though. No, it was a CRA.
It was not an executive order that overturned the Park Service regulations. It was Congressional Review Act, as I understand it. And I just saw something about the Fish and Wildlife Service ones in, I think, a Sportsman's Alliance magazine, that a lawsuit had been filed by professional hunters and SCI, I believe. And
SCI, the Safari Club International?
Yeah, Safari Club International, yeah.
Lawsuit to remove Alaska's right to manage wildlife filed. Here you go.
Okay.
Is that it?
Yeah. No, this is the National Preserves. Okay, well.
It's not. I'll send you what I have, Dick and Mary, just so I may be thinking about something different on this, but I just remember that the Park Service did their predator regulations first, and the Fish and Wildlife Service followed like a year and a half or 2 years later, but the Trump administration was able to overturn the Fish and Wildlife Service regulations because they were within 120 days of the new president taking office. And what you're describing, I know that the Park Service, under the Trump administration, those rules have been reviewed by Congress, but there's also an ongoing lawsuit with that, and I'm not clear about whether they've been overturned or not.
No, are these the regulations where they were about hunting bears in dens or
it was taking brown bears over bait, wolves in the spring during the denning period, etc.
Right.
And swimming caribou.
Okay. Yeah, it was very specific wildlife regulations. Okay.
Well, you got me. I
pointed out to future scholars, they need to look into this carefully.
Right. Somebody,
a bit of a moving target.
Right. Don't trust your guys' words on it. They need to go look it up in the congressional record. Anyway.
I'm glad you brought it up, Tom, because I would not want to leave that confused. But I guess I have for the moment.
Well, we've gone for a little over 2 hours, and I'm sure everybody is tired. So, Dick and Mary, I don't know if you have any other things you want to say about the Alaska Outdoor Council and their work and your work with them, or about anything you might want to add.
Well, the only thing I have is, if nothing else, all of that experience demonstrates that it's really important, but it's also very hard for the public to be well informed, get well informed, be well informed, be interested. And some of these issues, like the so-called D2 issue and the subsistence issue and so on, getting into the courts and the long bureaucratic processes, whether state or federal, it just turns people off. It's really hard to sustain an active interest among the general public, unless it happens to be something that comes back and hits them right between the eyes. Mm-hmm. It's liable to be ignored or forgotten or both. And that's always going to be a dilemma. I think it's a dilemma that fish and game management in general lives with.
The sausage making by legislative bodies ends up sometimes so difficult to understand, so vague, that it ends up going to court. And then you're in court for 20 years in order to figure anything out. It's just so expensive for the individual to deal with something like this.
Yeah, it's true. If somebody does get involved, and sturgeon is a good example, you know, it is, as Mary says, so expensive. There's any number of complaints that probably are legitimate, but there's no way that individuals or even small organizations can take them on in court, because it is so exhaustive, both psychologically, financially.
Yeah, so what motivated you guys to stay involved and active for so long?
Well, for me, it was that thing that ended up in my lap. And for Richard, he's always had this, you know, fish and game is his thing.
Right.
And a certain level of naivety. You know, here's this law coming up in Congress, to take the Anilka example again. That should be over in a couple, 3 years, and everything will be settled and people can get on with their lives, including me. Well, it didn't work that way. And for one thing, I didn't understand much about how Congress worked or how the politics of Congress worked. And I was definitely a country kid in a big city encountering that. And, you know, I thought, geez, this can't be this difficult. Just say it like it is and it'll get cleared up. Well, that was too easy an answer. But it kept pecking away. Couldn't let go.
Yeah. Well, do you have any advice for people now, and or how do you keep people from dropping out on issues or getting burned out?
Try to have some fun and some humor along the way.
Yeah, and there's been some of that, and that was helpful, even if sometimes it's kind of dark humor. But
try to be truthful. The worst thing in the world that can happen to you is to lose your credibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes things just happen by accident, but don't lose your credibility.
Yeah.
I guess, and the other thing is, just for the average person, if something doesn't strike them as being right, they really should raise a question with somebody, and it may be tough to figure out who, but it is important to raise the questions and challenge the assumptions and challenge the decisions that are made and how they're made. And, you know, some of that's been addressed by open meetings, publicly open meetings of government agencies and so on. And a lot of it is not. There's a lot that goes on that is never on a record anywhere. Sort of like, I think it was Huey Long said, never in politics, never write anything down. A smile or a wink is all the commitment you should make, or words to that effect. In other words, don't corner yourself with some scheme you have. So, you know, a lot of that stuff does go on. You know, eventually the substance of a lot of issues that get attention politically comes out, and it's often shown that what the headlines spoke of grossly overstated or misstated the provocation. But boy, it takes a long time for that to sink in and filter through. And so we have things like the recent election and the uproar over that, where so much stuff, I'll not use the word that comes to mind, was floating around, you know, that people really came to believe in, and it just created chaos. And it can be very difficult to sort it out. People react emotionally, and they react emotionally first, and as a rule, and look at the facts second, if they look at all. And
once you're emotionally involved, it's very difficult for anybody to make persuasive arguments in a different...
Convince you otherwise,
yeah. Once you're emotionally involved. Yep.
Yeah.
So... Well, there's your non-answer.
No, it's as you said, that it's hard for the public to get involved in all these issues because they can be so complicated and overwhelming and take so long. So it was just, you know, how do you encourage people to do that? And how have you encouraged people in all your years of doing this to keep engaged?
Education with simple... trying to resolve a complex problem down into as few simple points in an outline fashion. Mm-hmm. I think that is really essential. And I think that the Department of Fish and Game has done that with some of their predator-prey management stuff and their communication on it, which I think is really been good. I remember one of their publications was about moose, and Mike Terrace, I believe, was involved in that publication. And boy, it was good. I was so impressed with how well organized, point by point, it was, and logical. I just, that's That's the kind of educational stuff I think needs to be put out.
Okay, great. Well, Dick, did you have something else? You were reaching for something. I don't know if you had something else. Otherwise, I'd say.
Oh, I don't think I was reaching for it. It just reminded me that Jay Hammond had a unique ability to put things in persuasive terms. One that pops into mind was, he said, I liken the subsistence issue to pornography. Everyone recognizes it when they see it, but no one can define it. I think that happened when there was some uproar over pornography that happened to coincide with subsistence uproar. And he also had a really interesting thing on how to accommodate culture, which was part of what led to what I read earlier. He said, it's truly important, but it's hard to define, and basically he said it's impossible to put into regulation. And that was the conclusion I came to. You know, that is just an impossible task, and that's why we felt we had to go a different direction, acknowledge the importance of it, but deal with the regulatory matters that had to be dealt with in a different way without relying on criteria of culture, because they're amorphous and they change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not everything fits in the box of regulation.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I say, it's been a long 2.5. I mean, it's been a wonderful 2.5 hours to listen to you guys and learn from you. But I'm sure you're tired and have other things to do while we have daylight.
I have to pour water too.
You have to pour water. So I'm going to turn off the recording